So it may snow. That's a possibility. We're glad to see you here today at Morgantown Community Church. My name's Josh. I'm one of the pastors here. If we've never met, nice to meet you. And today I want to talk about, we want to wrap up a series we've been in called Core. And in the month of January, we started by talking about these four core values we have as a church and what that means for how we live and do life together. And so we're going to wrap that up today. And then next week and then the two following weeks, we're going to talk about Communion, Eucharist, Lord's Supper, which in Greek is the good gift. So we're going to spend a couple weeks talking about what that is for us, what it means, why it's significant, how we do it, why we do it that way, and those sorts of things. So that'll be the next 2 weeks, and then we'll go into all sorts of other things. Let's have a word of prayer, and we'll jump right in. God, we're grateful for this day. We're grateful for this breath, for this life you've given us. And our prayer today is that you would just help us to be open, open to what your Spirit's doing in us and through us, that we'd be open to the movement of God in the world. And we'll be open to joining the movement of God in the world. We ask all these things in the name of Jesus. And everybody said, amen. So I want to just kind of recap for a second where we've been, the other values we've talked about, because we were supposed to wrap this series up in January. We had a snow day, and you've slept since I gave these sermons. So I'm assuming, I know you hang on my every word, but I'm assuming there may be a chance that you've forgotten some of this. So, and there may be a chance I've forgotten. So we'll just look through it real quick. So we began by talking about the importance of valuing the image of God in everyone. So we live in a world that's deeply divided and seeks to be further divided. And we divide ourselves in all sorts of categories. And as a church, what we want to do is we want to meet people first and foremost as image bearers of God, because that's who you are before you're anything, before you're a Democrat, Republican, before you're Christian, Buddhist, whatever you are, before any of that stuff comes into play, you're an image-bearing creation of God. That's in you. That's your destiny. That's who you were made to be. And so before we start with all the labels, we just want to say everybody matters. Everybody has value and worth. Everybody deserves dignity and respect. Even if we disagree with each other, you deserve dignity and respect. And so everybody's made in the image of God. We want to value that. We value transformative community, which means we value community that's geared around actually making a difference in us and in some ways in the world. We've been having small group sign-ups. We have a couple groups right now who have nobody signed up for yet, and this is an opportunity to be a part of that, to be a part of transformative community. You can go to church every Sunday and sit beside in the same seat every Sunday and not have been a part of community and not be transformed. Are you with me? And if it's not about transformation, sometimes I wonder why we even do this, right? If it's not about us growing and changing, like, why do we do this? It's absurd. Why would we do this if we're not being changed? So we want to create environments like this, but also like small groups where, and other environments where you can engage with other human beings in community and be transformed. I was in a conversation this week where somebody said that somebody had told them a great definition of community is when people get together and do stuff. They're up to something, right? So they're not just spinning their wheels. They're in relationship with each other, and they're up to something in the world, something that will transform them and maybe the world, which leads us to missional engagement. We want to be involved and engaged in what's going on in the world around us. We have partnerships in the Dominican Republic. We have partnerships with the Morgantown Mission. We have our community care ministry, which right now is taking up items for cancer assistance who will be given to people who are undergoing cancer treatment. And Donna Meyer is somewhere. Donna Meyer's right back there, and she's in charge of that. She's one of our elders here, and she would love to connect you with ways to be a part of that. So we're trying to think about ways that we live as a community. And this last one I want to talk about is really, really important to me, and it's become really, really important to a lot of other people here, and that is that we are seeking to be a part of a faith that is both for our head and our hearts. Not just a faith for the head and not just a faith for the heart, but something that brings these two really important parts of us together in a satisfying way that helps us grow and be transformed and be a part of what God's doing in the world. And I want to start by talking about a group of people, which sounds awful. I realize when I say that. I just want to start by talking about an entire group of people, if I could, for just a moment. It's a group of people who are called the nuns. Not N-U-N-S, like back in the habit sort of nuns, but nuns, N-O-N-E-S. This group of people is a group of people in our country and the world who are on the rise. 1 in 5 Americans say they have no religious preference or affiliation. That's 20%. This is actually a couple years dated. It's more like 25 to 27 now. In 2007-ish, it was like 18. In 1990-something, it was like 7. So our culture has a very specific trajectory, and that trajectory is people are leaving organized religion at rapidly increasing rates. So on any given morning, Sunday morning, 20% of the people aren't engaged in any sort of, and if you, like when you go fill out those surveys or people are asking you, maybe you are going for a hospital stay and they're like, what's your religious preference? We'll send a chaplain. Lots of people are just bubbling in, none, right? Of that 20%, 30 2%, and actually now it's 34 to 36, I saw yesterday. 34 to 36% of Americans aged 18 to 29 report none. It's the largest group. 18 to 29-year-olds, and actually, they're called millennials. How many of you have heard millennials before? They're a hot commodity right now, by the way. In an election cycle, millennials are a hot commodity. Everybody wants millennials. In the religious world, everybody wants to get the millennials. They're this younger set of people. They're beginning the workforce. They're beginning to build families. They're starting to make money, and everybody wants to get their hooks in the millennials. I'm technically one of those people, but I'm not 29. The millennial, like the cutoff, is like 1980s, 1981, depending on who you talk to. So I'm right at the beginning of that, and it ends somewhere in the 1990s. 32% of Americans, of millennials, 36% report that they have no religious affiliation or interest in organized religion at all. Now, what's really super interesting is the percentage of those people who identify as atheists is super, super small. By and large, these nuns are not atheists. If you were to talk to them, they would, and if you read all the statistics that are out there, they'll tell you they believe in God. And they'll use this line a lot. I'm not religious, I'm what? Spiritual. Right? They have a sense of more, capital M. They have a sense of mystery, capital M. They have a sense that when we look around at the interesting, beautiful world we live in, we can't just look around and say that all this is an accident. They don't have any sense of that. They have a very deep sense of spirituality. They have a deep sense of connection with God and with the world around them, with other human beings. They actually maybe have a bigger sense of that than a lot of religious people do in some ways. And yet they just aren't interested at all in being a part of anything that resembles organized religion. And if you really start listening to them, because I think one of the things that happens is when somebody, this happens, we just keep saying the same things but louder. How many of you have adopted that parenting strategy? Like, right? Yeah, I'll admit, I'm very guilty of that. Like, they don't listen, so you just say the same thing louder. Or you're speaking to somebody who doesn't speak your language, and you start going, hello, right? It's not helpful. It's not an issue of volume. It's an issue of understanding. And so we could do that. We could just keep saying the same things louder. We could just keep demanding that they agree with us. We could just keep telling them, you just have to fall into this sort of line, and they'll keep being pushed farther and farther away. Or we could begin to listen to them. And we could begin to listen to their critiques of our religious system and how we do things and what we're up to in the world. And when I've done that, part of my thesis was on this group of people for my master's degree. And so I spent time talking to my friends who are millennials, who are across the board, spiritual but not religious, atheists, all those groups. I spent time with them, just asking them questions about how they see religion and why it's a problem in the world. And I found this a lot, that a lot of them have problems with politically co-opted religion. Now, I know that you have probably not seen this on television lately, because we're in an election cycle. And one of the things I've noticed and that I've heard from people in this group is that on both sides of the party system, Democrats and Republicans, they hear this all the time. So somebody wins something and they stand up and they thank Jesus, and yet half the things they've said could not even be closely reconciled to anything Jesus has ever said, right? Do you see what I'm saying? And yet there's a certain group of Christians who are so excited to hear somebody with influence say the name of Jesus that they're like on full board, right? You said Jesus, you said Bible, sign me up. The reality is, anybody can say Jesus, and anybody can say Bible, and what most of them are doing, Democrats, Republicans, and neutral people, are trying to convince you that they're on your side. This is why every time somebody in Hollywood gives a speech at the Oscars and they thank God for something, that's why Christians blow up the internet over it. We're desperately needing to be validated. And actually, we don't need that, right? And so there's this problem. Like, we're sick and tired, they say, of politically co-opted religion. We're sick and tired of economic injustices that are propped up by religion. When churches build bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger buildings, and there are people starving to death in the world, that doesn't seem like a very Jesus thing to do, for example. Religious consumerism. This was a big deal when I was growing up, because when I was cutting my teeth in ministry in the 90s, one of the things that started happening was the contemporary church movement. And when the contemporary church movement started, in the Baptist church I grew up in, we were having battles about drum sets, right? And if you play the drums, somehow you're almost Pentecostal, so you have to be very careful about that, because that would have made everybody uncomfortable, right? Cannot do anything that resembles any form of Pentecostalism. But there's this sense of, we created a religious goods and services industry where you just went to the church that had the newest cool thing. Right, so it was like, well, you have a fog machine, I'm into that, until they let it off in the service and you start coughing and your asthma acts up. You're like, I can't go to that church anymore. You do this the way I want you to do it. So essentially, church became just another marketplace where people were trying to one-up themselves all the time to get people to come to their thing and give money to it, right? And I got to tell you, millennials are not, I have not yet met very many millennials who are like, I need a better light show at church to feel deeply fulfilled in my faith. Not that there's anything wrong with that. If you have the money to do it, we could power one light and it wouldn't be a show, right? But if you can afford to do that, whatever. It's just not, they don't have the religious consumer mentality that maybe that existed during the baby boom period, right? Really big problem with religiously baptized violence. When we start talking about violence and putting God's name on it, millennials have this sense that that is not congruent with the message of Jesus, period. You can nuance it. You can say what you want about it. You can twist it and make it whatever you want it to be. Religiously baptized violence is never consistent with the message of Jesus. Religious hypocrisy, which doesn't exist anymore, but they keep talking about it. It's a joke, right? Now, there's this tendency in me when people talk about hypocrites. I don't go to church because of hypocrites. I always just want to say, we've got room for one more. Right? Because that's just true. We're all hypocrites. Would you agree? And if you don't agree right now, hypocrite. Right? Because we're all hypocrites. We all say things. Like, we all tell people to do things that we don't do. Right? There are things we all believe are like maybe God's will or what we should do with our lives. Like how many of you believe that it's a really good thing for somebody to just live simple and give all that they can to the poor? How many of you believe that's a great idea? You know why you're not raising your hand? You don't want to be a hypocrite, but you definitely think that's a good idea. I do too. I'm not doing it, but I think it's a great idea for those people, right? There are people who are doing it in the world. There are. But we have this sense of, you know, there. And I think part of the problem is you have these religious leaders who stand up and essentially say, and I'll never forget when one of the pastors who kind of trained me when I was younger said, you always have to have it together in front of your church and you should always be dressed better than they are. I was like, but that makes you really uncomfortable all the time. Why would you want to do that? But you always have to have it together. And I remember thinking this morning, if I got up one Sunday and told you I have it all figured out and together, I think you'd laugh me out of here. I really do. Because if you know me, and you know that's just not even remotely in the ballpark of truth. But I think there's some sense of we invite people into a religious service and we want them, like, you be like us and you do what we say. And deep down, I mean, I'll tell you this. I have talked to pastors who I know for sure get up in front of their churches and say certain things that they don't believe in, because then they call you and say, how in the world do you get brave enough to say what you actually think? And then you're like, I'm just not, it's not bravery, it's stupidity. But you know, you just got to find your own special realm of stupid. And then you can do those things. But there's this sense of, I think lots and lots of pastors are up in front of their churches saying things they don't believe in. And it's creating a sense where lots and lots of people are going, if that's what I have to be, and you're looking, which feeds into judgmentalism, right? I mean, I was talking to somebody a couple weeks ago who said, I'd love to come to a church, but if I walk in, the building will fall down. And obviously that's a bit of an exaggeration, but there's a sense where people think, if I don't have it together, there's no space for me, church. If I can't come in and sign the statement and toe the party line and believe all the stuff they believe, there's no space for me there. And so there's large groups of people, maybe in this spiritual but not religious category, who would love to have a faith community to be a part of, even if they don't believe it all. Because everybody needs community, right? One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do, right? It is. And they want that, but they're not being given space for that. And that's a problem in the world. And then this religious anti-intellectualism that gets peddled about, which is like, if you use your brain, somehow God's not okay with that. I remember when I started education to be a pastor, people warned me, it's going to ruin you. You're going to lose it all. You're not going to have any beliefs when you come out of being trained to be a pastor. And I believe more deeply now than I've ever believed. I believe different things, but I believe them more deeply now than I've ever believed. But I just always find that interesting when people don't want their pastors to be educated. It'd be like you're going into open heart surgery and you talk to your heart surgeon and they say, I've never had a lick of training in this, but I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night, so I really do believe you're in great hands here. And we take that from our religious leaders who are helping shape our spiritual lives. That just sounds a bit crazy to me. And we've created a system where if you use your brain, somehow that makes you less faithful. And what we want to talk about here is how in the world do we create a faith that is meaningful and viable for both our heads and our hearts? These people exist. I met one this past week. I was in New York City this week for some meetings, and I hadn't been to New York City since 1996 as a part of a tour bus. And I know we look like the Clampets have arrived in New York. You know, I was like 15. Our high school, if your parents would pay some money, you could go, and we did all the touristy things. This time, I was not on a tour bus. It was Josh alone until I found my friends in New York City. And so I got off the plane, and I got down, and I realized I had no plan for how to get from the hotel to down down into Manhattan where I was going to stay. I realized this as I'm leaving the plane, like, oh, I don't even know where I'm going or how I'm going to get there. So I go down, and I'd never done an Uber before. I didn't even have the app, so I thought, can't do that. So I just stand there with my bag, and some guy says to me, you need a ride? I said, yeah, I do. You going to Manhattan? I was like, is there any other place? And he says, come on, get in the car. And he's got this other guy following him who's about 23 and honestly looked like he's about to wet himself. He was there for a job interview. He's from Indiana, young guy. Job interview on Madison Avenue. He did not say three words the entire time we were in the car. Felt really bad for him. So we get in the car, and he drops him off first. And then I remember as he was driving, I had this sort of thought, like, I've not been this scared in a car based on how they're driving. The only thing I can liken it to is when you're riding in a car in the Dominican Republic, where there are no traffic laws, except blow your horn and go. Like, that's the... And he was doing those things, just honking on the horn, weaving over, weaving in and out. And I'm doing everything. I'm not Catholic, but I held Mary the entire time. Like, I was... Anything I could possibly do to make this work, I was doing. And I just remember thinking, I'm not going to make it where we're going. And I kept saying, it shows on my map we should go this way. He's like, I know where I'm going. I don't need your map. He's like, but you do. You're going that way, you know. And so I'm a little nervous. Well, then I decided I need to talk to the guy, and maybe that'll make me feel better. Because, you know, introvert, that's hard. But I just said, hey, what's your name? He said, my name is Juan. What's your name? Where are you from? I said, I'm Josh. I'm from Kentucky. I said, where are you? Where are you from? He said, I'm from the Dominican Republic. I was like, I know you are. I could tell. Because you got the horn thing down. And so we start having a conversation. He says, what do you do and why are you here in New York City? And, you know, that's a really, really tough question for a pastor because everything in you wants to lie at this point. Because it's going to take the conversation somewhere awkward usually. Like, I've been on airplanes. What do you do? I'm a pastor. Oh, I'm the best Christian at my entire church. Well, that's probably not true because I just saw you cuss at the flight attendant. But anyway, that's neither here. We're there, and so I said, Juan, I'm a pastor, and I'm here to meet with some other pastors. We're trying to do some good work in the world. And he's like, oh, I grew up religious. I've got lots of friends who are religious. They're all jerks. He didn't say jerks. I'll let you creatively go there. He didn't say jerks. And I was like, well, Juan, I used to be that kind of Christian. I know those kind of Christians. I'm struggling not to be one of those kind of Christians because it's kind of easy to do sometimes. And I just remember thinking, like, he used to be religious, he's not religious, and his friends, who I got the impression he doesn't hang out with, his friends are jerks who are religious. So he's not. He just doesn't associate with it. And I thought, these are real people in the world. It's not just a statistic or a category. These are real people in the world, and I meet them all the time. I meet them all the time. I meet people all the time who struggle because they have a sense of more. And they're not comfortable with the categories that of accident and chance. They want to believe in something. But no religious community is giving them space to believe or not believe in something as a part of that community. And so today I want to talk about what that looks like. What does it look like to create space for somebody to have a faith for the head and the heart and to give them time to get there, however long it takes? I want to look at one verse today. It's a verse from Hebrews chapter 11. You've probably heard this verse before. Or maybe not. I don't know what's going on. That's the home improvement. And this verse, Hebrews 11, 1, I'll just read it and then we'll talk a bit about it. Faith is the reality of what we hope for, the proof of what we do not see. Faith is the reality of what we hope for, the proof of what we do not see. I'm not working. Can we go to the next slide? These words, reality and proof. Faith is reality. Faith is proof. The NIV I grew up reading always said something like, faith is the certainty of what we, being sure of what you hope for and certain of what you do not see. And the more I read those verses this week, because I wanted to talk a bit about what faith is, one of the things I realized is I think that's a horrible translation, because I don't think that's what faith is. I don't think faith has anything to do with proof. I don't think faith has anything to do with certainty. I really don't. Because what does it mean to be certain? What does it mean to have proof? It means in your hands you can say, I have this. I have proof. I have certainty. Outside of a good feeling about it or outside of a sense of feeling about it, what proof do you have that God exists? What can you produce? You can say, I've sensed it in my heart. I believe it. But you can't prove it, right? Unless you have access to something I don't have access to, which is possible. So I really started wrestling with this verse because I just don't believe. I believe what we want is certainty. I do believe that. I think there are two things that modern church is giving people, and it's kind of destructive. We're giving people fear and certainty. That's what we're giving people, fear and certainty. Fear we don't need and certainty we cannot have. We have to give people something better than those two things. And the thing I would say that is better than those two things is faith. Next slide. When you begin to study the words that get translated, so every translation is an interpretation, by the way. When you translate from Hebrew to English or Greek to English, sometimes the words don't go, and so you have to interpret what the word means to make it make sense. If you read these words in Greek, this is a much better translation. Faith is the confidence of what we hope for and the conviction of what we don't see. Now, I can get behind that. Faith is a confidence, right? A confidence in the being and reality of God, confidence that you can trust this God, that this God is good, that this God is love, the conviction that some things matter and some things don't, the conviction that if we line ourselves up with the God we see revealed in Jesus, like that we will live a full, abundant, overflowing life, like that's conviction, that's confidence. But it's not the same thing as certainty, and it's not the same thing as proof. All right, Paul even addresses some of this in his letters where he talks about, I see now through a glass darkly, i.e., I don't see it all. I feel confident and I feel certain. Like, I feel confident, not certain, I feel confident and I'm convicted that the God we see revealed in the life of Jesus is how God actually is. I feel confident that you and I know about this much about God. I think God is bigger and more mysterious than you and I can ever get our head around. And if somebody tells you they have God figured out, run. Right? But I definitely feel confident that the God I see revealed in the person of Jesus, this God of love and this God of compassion and this God of goodness, this God of justice for the oppressed and the poor, like that is the God I believe exists. And I am confident and convicted that that's how God is. But there's a big difference in certainty and confidence and conviction. Next slide. So today, I just want to take a few moments and I want to talk about what it means to have a faith for both the head and the heart. Next. One of the things I hear from people sometimes is this statement. How many of you have heard this before? A closed Bible and an open mind, or an open Bible and a closed, or open mind and a closed Bible. How many of you have heard this before? Anybody ever told you this before? Which is kind of like, don't be open to anything that you haven't heard before, right? Be afraid of new ideas. Be afraid of different thoughts. Be afraid. I remember somebody telling me once, you're going to become so open-minded, your whole brain's just going to fall out. that's an interesting image to have happen to you. I don't think these are our only options. I think you can have an open Bible and an open mind, and that those two things can go together in a really beautiful way in the world. So I want to show you next. I want to show you a picture. This is a guy named Galileo. How many of you have heard of Galileo before? Galileo got in a bit of trouble in the 1600s. In 1633, Galileo was tried for heresy by the church. Will you indulge me for just a second? Because I found this great meme on the internet. I just want to show it to you. Okay, next slide. I throw my telescope in the air sometimes singing, "Ayo, I'm Galileo." If you don't know the song that references, you're totally lost. But for those of you that laughed, you gave me a gift. Thank you. Next slide. In 1633, Galileo was condemned as a heretic for his heliocentric ideas. Heliocentric means Galileo started teaching that the sun, not the earth, was at the center of the universe. Up until around this point, people had always believed that the earth was at the center of the universe and that the sun revolved around the earth. And it was obvious because the sun starts in the east and it moves to the west. It rises in the east, moves across the sky, and it sets and goes away in the west. It was clear. And then they would reference Bible passages because there's this passage in the book of Joshua where the sun stands still. Right? Well, the sun stood still. Obviously, the sun stops moving, so something is happening. It's standing still. And Galileo and Copernicus and some of these people got their hands on a new invention called a telescope. And when they got their hands on this new invention called the telescope, this older way of seeing the universe began to crack and break apart. Because when they looked up into the sky, what they began to see was, the sun isn't moving. We are. You knew this, right? You can't take things for granted, because I saw there are a new group of people who are flat earth people, and they're trying to convince people that NASA has built a wall to keep us from falling off the earth, right? So you just can't take things for granted even in 2016. The earth is not the center of the universe. The sun is. And so the earth revolves around the sun. And while the earth is going around the sun every 365 days, it spins. And every spin is a 24-hour day. So right now, we are on a ball of dust and gas hurtling through the universe, spinning the entire time. No wonder sometimes you get car sick. Right? I mean, how could you not? You're constantly moving. But when Galileo begins to say these sorts of things, it makes religious people uncomfortable. They have a vested interest in keeping things how things are. Religious people and politicians often have a vested financial line-in-their-pockets interest in keeping things are. Status quo is their best friend. The minute you begin questioning the status quo, you become expendable. And so in 1633, Galileo is convicted of heresy by the church, and he's sentenced to house arrest where he would die. I want to read you the conviction that they read to him. "We pronounce, judge, and declare that you, the said Galileo, have rendered yourself vehemently suspected by this holy office of heresy." By the way, I have gotten emails that start just like that. It's very interesting that they're still saying these sorts of things. "Suspected by the holy office of heresy. That is, of having believed and held the doctrine which is false and contrary to the holy and divine scriptures, that the sun is the center of the world." Next. "And that it does not move from east to west. And that the earth does move and is not the center of the world." "Galileo, we condemn you of heresy because you looked at the universe and learned something new that challenges what we've always been taught." Galileo died in house arrest. In 1992, 300 years later, the church reversed their decision and said, this Galileo may have been onto something. Isn't that just like the church? 300 years too late. On most important issues in the world. Interesting. We don't learn from our mistakes. Next. We talked about this last week. All truth is God's truth. And Galileo was not in a tradition at that point that gave him the space to learn something new. But he also had this sense of he'd seen it. He learned it. He experienced it. He couldn't go back. He couldn't now look through a telescope and say, "Oh, you're right, the earth is actually at the center and everything's moving." He couldn't. He was so convicted by what he had learned about the universe and how it was made. This past week, I don't know if you followed the news, but they discovered something Einstein postulated and predicted back in his day, that there were these things called gravitational waves, that somehow at the beginning of the universe, there was so much energy that created this. I read four articles, and the only thing I know is gravitational wave, by the way. I'm going to tell you really some bad science, and then we'll move on. But the sense of whatever happened at the beginning of the universe created these waves, and by studying these waves, they can begin to get insight into how the universe began and all those other sorts of things. If it were 1633, what would happen to these people? They'd be sentenced to house arrest for teaching us something new that we've discovered about how God chose to create the wild, wonderful world we live in. If all truth is God's truth, then when you learn something new and it's true, it's ultimately, it belongs to God. God is not threatened by it. God is the source of it. If gravitational waves exist, then they belong to God. And we don't need to fear them. Right? We desperately want to create a space where people can bring. I know I am a person who struggles at times. I have doubts. I have uncertainties. There's things I just don't know. Now, people who know me would probably tell you I seem like I'm always right, but that's just, I'll publicly admit it, I'm not. Lots of times, the last 10 to 15 years, I have had to go back and change my mind. Lots of times I go back and look at sermons I gave here in 2005, 6, 7, and 8, and I think, oh my goodness, I need to issue a public apology because that was just wrong. We need to create a space where people can be honest about where they're at. Because those people we're talking about, the millennials, they're not in church, and they're not in church because they are not being given space to be who they are and question and be honestly searching for truth. We have a growing number of people in our church who, not publicly necessarily, but will talk to me and they'll say, I'm an atheist, I'm an agnostic. And I was talking about this with somebody and they said, don't you think it's a problem that you have atheists in your church? I said, don't you think it's a problem that you don't? Don't you think it's a problem that everybody in your church agrees with everything you say and they're never challenged by anything? Like, I would fear that. The moment when I look out and you're all going, yes, this is the moment I'm like, oh, I need to move on. I've lost my ability to provoke and challenge and teach these new exciting things I'm learning. And the reality is, if it's If it's new, it's not true. The reality is that gravitational waves have always been there. We just discovered them. Are you with me? The reality is the sun has always stood at the center of our universe, of our solar system. There were some people in 1633 who discovered it to be true. Theology and faith are not learning new things. They are just discovering what's always been there. And in some way, as we discover these things, we are discovering truths about God, truths about ourselves, and truths about the world. And we need to make space for those truths. And we need to make space for people in our midst who aren't there and may not ever want to be where we are, but they're interested in the Jesus we talk about. And wherever you are on the journey, there's a spot for you here. Like, that's what needs to be. That's what a church is. It's a space, not where we all agree, but it's a space where we're all taking those steps together on a journey. And it's life-giving, and you're better for it. I am better for my atheist friends. Can I just tell you this? They're some of the nicest human beings I know, which is very confusing to me at times. Like, what? But Christian said this to me, and you said this to me. I think I like you, right? You know what I'm saying? There's this sense of, like, we need to learn from each other. And so we need to develop a faith for our head that makes sense, but a faith where we can say, these are the things I understand about God and the universe, and I feel confident, and I trust them, right? But I've thought about them. And I've not turned my brain off. Galileo actually said it like this. Next. Oh, I skipped a quote. Essentially, Galileo said this. I cannot believe that the God who gave me a brain wants me to turn it off and not use it. That the God who gave me this curiosity, there it is. I do not feel obliged to believe that the same God who has endowed us with sense, reason, and intellect has intended us to forego their use. Which probably needs to be said to college students on spring break. I don't know. But that's a whole other sermon. So a faith for the head. But what about a faith for the heart? Because I think if all you have is sort of a cold, calculated, rational thought process behind faith, that seems very sterile and boring and not interesting. Today is Valentine's Day, by the way. How many of you knew this? How many of you need to get out of here quickly and go to IGA and get a box of Hershey Kisses or something because you forgot? So Valentine's Day, and on Valentine's Day, we celebrate love. And isn't love a great thing sometimes? Like, isn't love great? But when you think about love, think about, like, I'm pretty sure science, and I've read articles on this, science can tell us why we fall in love. They try. They tell us things like, in our brain, there's these weird cocktails of hormones that make us think and do things, right? And that some, like, for example, the lust portion of our brain, the part that makes us lust, is very, very ancient part of our brain that was developed before everything else. And so really, when you fall in love with somebody, all you're doing is your body is trying to tell you, you need to make more human beings in the world so we don't die out. Right? Which is, can you imagine saying that to somebody, asking them on the first date? Look, there's this weird cocktail of hormones in my brain right now, and I just feel the need to procreate. Are you free? Like, that's just not how you do that. And that's not compelling, and it's boring. And actually, that's not what's going on. That may be happening, but that does not explain why people lay their lives down for other people. If survival is our instinct, and I think it is, it doesn't explain why you love somebody so much that you jump in front of a bullet for them or a moving train. It doesn't explain those sorts of things. Love is something bigger. It cannot be confined to the head, and it cannot just be studied under a microscope. It's almost I would say love is a spiritual reality because God is love. Love is a spiritual reality. This sort of, I'm not talking about lust. I'm talking about this sort of deeply connected love where you would give your entire being for another human being. And we need a faith that meets us there. A faith that moves us to action. Because I think in some ways, even anti-intellectual people, still, their faith ends up just being intellectual in the sense that here's the things we believe, we sign off on the belief statement, and that's what Christianity is about. Instead of hearing a story and thinking, oh my word, there are people starving to death, I need to do something about it. That's not evolution, that's a movement of God. That's God at work in us, right? That's love demanding more from us than our brains should ever be able to get to. Right? It's having a faith that sees the pain and suffering of the world around you, and you're moved in empathy to do something about it. That's what love is. Abraham Joshua Heschel puts it like this. It is customary to blame secularism for the eclipse of religion in modern society, but it would be more honest to blame religion for its own defeats. Religion declined not because it was refuted, but because it became irrelevant, dull, oppressive, and insipid. When faith becomes an heirloom rather than a living fountain, when religion speaks only in the name of authority rather than with compassion, its message becomes meaningless. Faith is not the clinging to a shrine, but an endless pilgrimage of the heart. Because the reality is the deepest decisions you make in your life, whether it's about God or the person you love, or whatever, the deepest decisions in our lives are not made by what makes sense. They're made by being moved in the deepest part of who you are. And so we want to create a space where people can cultivate a faith with their questions and doubts, with all the head stuff that needs to be dealt with. And yet also we're giving them space to feel with their hearts. So let's let that sit for a minute. I want to introduce a friend to you, and we're going to hear a bit of a story. Is that okay? And then we'll get you out of here so you can go get your milk and bread and lose your Christianity throwing punches at the checkout or whatever that's going to look like. So everybody welcome Alicia Johnson as she comes this morning.
Good morning.
There you go. Alicia, thanks for being here today. We were supposed to, this was sermon and this talk was supposed to happen on the Sunday. We got snowed out a few weeks ago. So I'm really glad. We felt it was so important. That was one of the decisions why we didn't meet that day was if the parking lot's a wreck, it's really snowy, but this is something that people need to hear in our church, and it snowed again. So, but we have some people here, and so we're going to hear your story. Alicia, could you just talk a little bit about how long you've been here and what it was that brought you to MCC?
I've been here a little over a year, and what essentially brought me was my mom and dad. They started coming first and asked me to come and just check it out and see if it would be something I would be interested in.
Okay. So prior to that, your experience with church is what?
I've had some good experiences, some not so good experiences, and also, as I said before in the earlier service, I have had a lot of questions and doubts that I've struggled with for years when it comes to Christianity.
And you were talking about, you mentioned at 9 o'clock, like the stuff we had up there, the nuns and all the things, that's you.
Yeah, pretty much. You were pretty much talking about me the whole time. I was like, yep, every bullet point you had on the reasons that the nuns don't feel comfortable attending churches, that all of those appeal or they apply to me. So.
Which is, they're real, right? So it's not just this category of those, but like we have people in our community and more than Alicia who would say, that's me. I'm one of those people. So,
but I just turned 30, so I'm not one of the, I'm not the millennial. I was like, I'm right out of that category.
30 is the new 15, so you just rock it. You've been coming here for about a year. Can you talk a little bit about, can we talk about when you came to see me first? Because we didn't really know each other, and then you came to see me.
With struggling with those questions and doubts, I always thought, I didn't like them. I didn't like that I had questions and doubts, and I wished that it would have come to me easily, as it seems to do for some people. I remember thinking that why can't I just believe and have that faith and that lack of doubt that some people do, but it wouldn't go away.
I don't know that they really do.
I thought that they did, and I wanted to be that, but it never happened as much as I wanted it to. So, for years, like I said, I struggled, and I did try to read some books, try to do some research on my own, but I wasn't able to find a church that I would feel welcome to going to. So my mom actually suggested that I speak to you, and as I said before, I expected, because I had never voiced my doubts or concerns with a pastor, I expected a confrontation. So I expected to be told that I was wrong and that I just need to believe. And I didn't expect to walk out of there feeling that it was okay, that I still had those doubts and fears. So it was not what I expected, our meeting that we had. So
what was that like then, walking out and essentially being given space to be where you were?
Well, it definitely made me feel welcome, where I wouldn't say that, I don't want to say that's true for all churches. I'm sure that there are other ones like this one, but not that I was aware of at the time. That I wouldn't have felt that I was still welcome to come back on the Sunday unless I had changed my viewpoint. So it was still a very welcoming feeling. And that, as I said before, even at the place I am in or was in at the time, there's still a place for me here. And I can still follow Jesus's teachings wherever you are in the spectrum. Whether you're a devout Christian or an atheist, there's still something to learn. And you can start being a better person today. You don't have to get everything answered first and then move on from there.
I think that's so important. This idea, I don't know where we got it, you have to figure everything out and then you can start to grow and be changed. It's
This, what you're talking about is you just grow where you are and you take steps, which is what our whole mission's about here, just taking the next right step. So what is it about MCC and being a part of this that has been a part of that meaningful process of you taking those steps?
Well, like I said, I feel like what you teach about Jesus and what we hear, I can take today and try to be a better person today. So I feel that even though I do still have doubts and questions and concerns, that I can still start today with being a better person. And I don't feel like they're obstacles or stumbling blocks the way I used to feel that they were.
Yeah. So. Faith, it's what's interesting is faith and doubt aren't opposites. In some ways, it's the doubt that makes space for the faith. So what else do you want to share with us today? Is there anything else you want to share about your experience here at MCC and what it's meant to you?
No, it's just I continue to want to go here because it's a positive experience. I'm definitely not anywhere near the end of my spiritual journey or whatever you would call it. So I still have a lot to learn and I still need to continue trying to improve myself. But I feel like this is a good place to do that. And it's a positive message that anyone can benefit from, not just a select group of people who feel the way you do. So,
yeah. Well, Alicia, thank you so much. Can you thank Alicia for sharing with me? So we're essentially trying to make space for the lots and lots of people who are coming here who are like Alicia and like so many of us who say, gosh, I just don't have all the answers. And I think deep down, even if you believe you do, you know you don't. And it's trying to create space, because one of the things I've learned in my own journey is when I spent all those years ignoring what I was thinking and just saying what I was supposed to say, I didn't grow. But it was in the acknowledgement of the struggle, in the acknowledgement of the doubt, in the acknowledgement of the uncertainty that somehow made space for the Spirit of God to do things in my life that weren't possible when I wouldn't just be honest about it. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was something about that honesty of, gosh, I don't know, that created space for God to do interesting and beautiful things. Let's have a word of prayer, shall we? God, we're grateful for this community that has given space for just complete, devout, unquestioning believers and for people who aren't sure. And may we continually be the kind of community that can hold these groups together. Continually be the kind of community who talks about Jesus and the way Jesus calls us to live and be in the world. And may we be the kind of community that follows this Jesus on the next right step. The next right step of transformation. The next right step of trust. So that we can be people in this world who live with Jesus, live like Jesus, and help the world become more and more the dream you have for it. We're grateful. We ask these things in Jesus' name, and everybody said, amen.